This conference will now be recorded.
It's Wednesday, March 18th, 2015, and this is the final discussion for the 2014-15 Reading Odyssey Herodotus Reading Group. And Rebecca, over to you. So,
yeah, I just want to say, you know, it's been a really challenging experience, I think, for all of our readers. One of the things that I really want to say, though, you know, kudos to you know, those of our readers, especially Leah and Dwight and Katarina, who especially made most of the calls and who really seemed to, every time, bring interesting insights. You know, Fred, who couldn't make it tonight, also very wonderful, and a bunch of people I'm forgetting just because I don't have my list in front of me.
Dwight Green, maybe Al Davis.
Yeah, definitely Dwight.
Elizabeth Bernard. Yeah.
Yeah, and Alex is not here with us as well. He calls in from Greece typically, so it's a little more difficult for him. But everyone has been really great. Everyone stepped up to the challenge. We've had a really great, inmate led conversation every week. I've sort of let them take us where we want to go, and really try and get into the nuts and bolts of, you know, what is Herodotus doing with this text, and why has this text really stood the test of time, in such an important way. So,
yeah,
I mean, that's really, we've really sort of dug into some very specific aspects of the text, especially his the more anthropological aspects, I think, has been the ones that we've really been spending some time on and interested in during the course of our venture.
Yeah. So. Great. Well, it's a thrill to be here with you. And you know, I was saying to I think to Katarina and Elizabeth earlier that I think in the future, I want for everyone who's read Herodotus with us, I think we should print a certificate and mail it. It's a great achievement. And Herodotus is it's my favorite book, as I like to say, my favorite book of all time. And Paul Cartledge is one of my favorite people of all time. Paul, I want to say a few words about you, and then let's get started. So first of all, Paul is calling in from England, which means I don't remember if it's midnight or 1 a.m. Paul, with the change of time, have you guys changed time at the same time the U.S. has? What time is it there? Paul? I thought I heard his voice earlier. Didn't he say hello earlier? I thought I heard.
He did say hello.
Paul, are you on mute perhaps? Okay. Well, he will call me or email me if he's having trouble. Or maybe he lost the connection and we'll get it back momentarily, I hope.
Yeah, I just heard a beep a moment ago. I don't know if that was something.
Okay. Well, Paul is... He is one of my favorite people, really, of all time. I mean, he's, as Rebecca wrote in her note to you, he is widely recognized as one of the greatest living classicists today. He has written more than 125 journal articles, and he's written many, many books. He's constantly on TV and radio in England, and he is unbelievably gracious. I don't know how he does it, to tell you the truth, but he, every single time we want him to join a call, he's there, and he's on the board of the Reading Odyssey and is really the heart of the whole program. So he will call back, I'm sure, unless something has happened. So maybe we can start with I would love to hear a little bit about how, now that you're at the end of reading Herodotus, and I know a few of you haven't finished the text, but I think many of you have. What do you, how has it impacted you now looking back at this experience? How has Herodotus changed you or changed the way you see, or what is resonating with you? What is kind of vibrating in your mind as you think back to this book? Anybody
want to? Hi, it's Leah here.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, man. I am about to graduate high school, which means that I read Herodotus while I was going through the college process and going through a very emotional time in my life. And it when I was reading Herodotus, it was distinctly an escape. It was it brought me back to the ancient world, and it was just a way for me to escape from the stress and worry of everyday life, and then just delve into this ancient world, which Herodotus paints such a vivid picture of.
Yeah.
And tonight I'm feeling very nostalgic. You know, it's a it's a wild ride, start to finish. And this course really has shaped the way that I think about the ancient world, shaped the way I think about ancient texts, and even anthropology. I mean, he did case studies on all these different people of the Middle East and in Turkey, and just it really made me think differently that there are, you know, it's not just Athenians and Spartans. It's the Lydians and the Carians and the Aeolians.
Forget the Scythians. Yeah.
Oh, don't forget the Scythians, of course. oh, God, can't forget those. So,
forget the Scythians.
Yeah. So I just, man, and I just feel like I have such a better grasp of understanding of the ancient train of thought. And I feel like sometimes the best books are when you forget that you're reading a book. And that happened to me many, many times during during this process. And I just want to say thank you to everybody involved, and especially Rebecca, who has been amazing and one of the best teachers I've ever had. So thank you.
Wow. You're welcome.
Wow.
Too bad you're not coming to Denison for college. I mean,
where are you going? Yeah.
Also, I hope you don't mind. I sort of wrote about this course for one of my applications to college. I'll send it along if you want, but really did make that big of an impact on my life that I would write about it to submit it to a college. So,
you know, Leah, I have to tell you, it is so for me as nearing the age of 50, so exciting to hear someone your age so engaged with this text and a vibrant part of this call. It's you have to help us find more people like you, and we should definitely talk about an internship while you're in college.
Absolutely.
with the Reading Odyssey.
Absolutely.
But wow, where are you going to school, by the way?
See, I haven't decided. I applied to many schools. I was accepted to St. Andrews in Scotland, and I was accepted to the University of Vermont, and I'm still waiting to hear back from a couple of women's colleges and a couple of Ivies, which is a stretch, but I thought, you know, may as well give it a shot.
Yeah.
But I'll let you know when I find out.
Any school will be lucky to have you, boy.
Oh, thank you. Wow, thanks.
No, yeah, but you did apply to Denison, so I just don't know. What can I do?
I didn't know what's wrong with her,
Rebecca. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, great, great. Well, Paul, are you back with us by chance?
Should we maybe email Kristen and see if she can try and call him?
Well, actually, I have his cell phone number, and I can put you on hold and try calling him. So hang on a minute.
Okay.
I wonder if something happened.
We can maybe talk without you.
Yeah, I will keep going, Rebecca. Exactly.
Yeah, anyone else want to say anything?
Yeah, how about some of your other feelings about Herodotus? He's been one of the most influential texts in history. Anybody else sort of feel a profound change in their person, in their life, having read Herodotus?
Well, this is Katarina here. I'll just
hello, Katarina.
Hi. And I just want to say also,
I'm sorry to miss you recently.
Oh yeah, no, I enjoyed the call, even though I didn't make it the last one. I enjoyed listening to the recording, and I want to say also thank you to everyone, especially you, Rebecca, because this was really a pleasurable experience and an educational one, and I really enjoyed it. So I just wanted
right.
to, yeah, I mean, this is the first time I've read Herodotus, and I think what really struck me was I got the sense pretty early on that to me he seemed to be more of a truth seeker than a historian. And so I was mm-hmm. really curious about the debate about whether the text was true or not. And I didn't really get that at first. And I sort of abandoned that and just continued to read it. And I was really struck because you wonder how many historians really cite divine intervention or, you know, a lot of the superstitions that came up and some of the absurd things that we read at the same time talking about things that were going on in battle and in the legal system and, you know, the structure of society at that time. So I really enjoyed the ending where the last sentence is where he writes, soft places tend to produce soft men, for the same land mm-hmm. cannot yield both wonderful crops and men who are noble and courageous more. And so the Persians agreed with him and departed, leaving him alone. They had lost the argument with Cyrus and chose to dwell in a poor land rather than to be slaves to others and to cultivate the plain. And I thought, if that's not an invitation to cultivate self-awareness and be the master of one's own ship or destiny, I thought that that was really poetic at the end. So I thought
yeah,
it did end
quite.
Sort of, it did come full circle for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I love about that particular passage as well, is that one of the things he talks about earlier in the text is how really crappy, to use a sort of unsophisticated term, Greek land is. In Greece.
Yeah.
So that Greece itself becomes this cradle of intellectual self-reflection of the type that Herodotus is promoting because the soil is so bad, as it were.
Which we could even say about human nature and egoism. So there, I think he was working some metaphors in there, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Absolutely.
Were you surprised at how much you liked the book?
Me or anyone in general?
Yeah, you actually. Yeah, but I'm interested in anyone else.
I think I sort of set out wanting to like it. So, and I don't normally set out looking for reasons to say, oh, well, this doesn't make sense or that isn't true. I just didn't get too hung up on that, which is why I think I did enjoy it because I really didn't know too much about the backstory and all the debates since I'm not a historian. And I entered this really curious about the process as a writer. And that's why I really enjoyed the last call, because they got more into that. And I think everyone's observations were really insightful. And I would like to know if we could ask the professor tonight about the process of, you know, what he learned about how he may have gathered this information. If, in fact, one sole author could have been responsible for this whole test, it just seems implausible. There was just such a breadth of information that was covered that unless he was a superhuman being and using powers that are latent to the rest of us, and maybe this was a very advanced civilization, who knows? I mean, maybe people did have these divine qualities that they were able to cultivate. I don't know. I mean, he mentions that at one point in the end, in this last book.
Yeah.
I forget which character it was. He said, here it is, and I can't pronounce his name, Evenius? Aeonius? Euenios. He was the one who, with that sacred flock at the son of Apollonia, how at some point he acquired powers of divination. I mean, can we verify that? And how do we verify that?
So hold your thought for a moment, because Paul is now with us. I'm very
excellent.
Happy to say. Paul, welcome. I think he's with us. He emailed me to say he was on the phone. He's on the phone now. Oh, let me email him back. Paul, do you hear me? Do you hear us? We can't hear you. Might be on the wrong. What we know about how Herodotus wrote this
is a great question for Paul. I have, you know, I've learned some things about that, but I'd actually like to have him weigh in on that question. So let's hold
a second.
Yeah,
I'm not going to touch that thing with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. all right. Well, I'm sorry we're having so much trouble tonight with Paul joining us. I'm guessing is he might be on. I wonder if he's on the right line. Because he might be using my PIN or my code.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I just called in the same way that they called in. And I did not use my organizer code. I just used the right
code. Yeah, I use the organizer. So I'm the organizer. We have an organizer, but I'm thinking he might be using my code since so many of our calls are with my code. So I just emailed him again to see. We'll figure this out one way or another. Actually, you know what? Maybe I'll call him one more time and just patch him in that way. Hang on.
Oh yeah.
Great idea.
Hey Rebecca, this is Bill. While we're waiting,
Bill?
Is there any comparable Persian Herodotus to review or look at or read?
There is not, actually. This is one of the things that that I think is in many ways that makes Herodotus so unique is that there isn't anything comparable, whether it's on the Greek or the Roman side, or sorry, the Greek or the Persian side. The closest thing we have from the Persians are the king's actual records of his own events. So one thing that we've been able to do in recent days is fact check some of the things that Herodotus has done based on archaeological finds. And so if you want to see the way that the Persian king represents his own, how Darius represents himself becoming the king of the Persians, he made a huge inscription on the side of a mountain that recounts his own
version.
Okay,
guys.
Oh,
I am here with Paul. Paul, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Hi, is that Rebecca?
Yes, hello, Paul.
Hi, look, I'm so sorry about the time mix-up, and also I've been having trouble getting in on the phone, but now Phil's done the business, so here I am.
Hello. Hi. Welcome. Questions for you.
Yeah.
Let me just give him a quick intro. Again, Paul, I was saying earlier, I thought you were on the line. I was confused. I said that Herodotus is my favorite book of all time, and you are one of my favorite people of all time. Which is very true. And you've been so generous. You're really the heart of the Reading Odyssey, and it's really terrific. So this group that Rebecca has been leading, first of all, Paul, I think going forward, we need to design some kind of really official, beautiful certificate that we give to every person who's finished reading the entirety of Herodotus. Don't you think? I mean, it's...
Yeah, and it should be, of course, in Herodotian Greek.
Yes.
So, Phil, tell me before you go any further, how many do we have online, and where are people? Are they scattered, or are they all in one rough geographical area?
They're scattered across the country.
Excellent.
We've got about 12 to 15 people here. We also have a couple of veteran Reading Odyssey readers who've just joined because, you know, they want to hear you speak.
They must have heard me before.
And I want to say that, you know, this has been such a great group. We have there's a wide age range. For example, we have a reader named Leah who is a high school student.
Right.
Who has just finished her
I just turned 18, so technically I'm an adult. So.
Woohoo!
All right.
But you're a senior at high school.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And is really enthusiastic and is, I think, already signed up to be an intern for the Reading Odyssey in college, which is great. And then we have folks like Elizabeth Bernard, who participated in other Reading Odyssey groups. She's an attorney here in New York. And then also Al Davis and Dwight Green have participated. I forget, guys, where are you from? Al and Dwight?
I'm in New Jersey. San Jose, California.
San Jose. Oh, right.
There we go. And then the Rebecca, Valley. You're in Ohio right now. Is that right?
I am back in Ohio, North Carolina? Yes.
Yeah.
I was in Providence, Rhode Island the last 2 days at Brown, and now I'm back in Ohio.
Okay. Cool. So it's a great group of diverse and passionate group of readers, and with lots of questions for you, Paul.
Okay, so, and you might have to relay them because they're coming through a bit faint to me, but
okay.
I can just about hear in the background, but I can hear you very clearly.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So I'll see if we can have people speak up because it's great if you can hear them directly.
Yeah.
So I think it was it you, Katarina? We were just talking, and you have a question about the how he wrote this and so forth. Do you want to ask Paul your question?
I think can you hear me, Paul?
Yes, I can now, Katarina. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And it, basically, that is the question: how one author was able to collect so much information from so many different sources to know the ins and outs of the rumors, what happened on the battlefield, what happened in the bedroom.
Yeah.
How was all this possible?
And he didn't have an iPad or anything to store his information. So the thing of it was that they lived, and we use the word oral. We mean that word of mouth was typically the way in which information was conveyed. So in order to be able to function in an oral universe, you have to have not only a very quick wit and understanding and the ability to respond and so on, but you've actually got to have a fantastic memory. And this is something that we, because we have all these mechanical devices, we've just forgotten, literally forgotten, what it is to remember. And so the ancients made quite a fetish of how to remember. So, yes, Herodotus had to be pretty fit. That's to say, not good-looking, but healthy. He had to be pretty wealthy in order to be able to afford to travel as widely as he did. He had to have very good personal contacts with people at all sorts of levels, not so much people just in the marketplace, but priests or even office holders in politics. He couldn't speak, apparently, any language except Greek, and therefore he relied on interpreters. And interpreters could be either natives who spoke Greek or Greeks who spoke the relevant foreign language. So in a way, he was at the mercy sometimes of his interpreters. And there's a funny bit, I don't know if you've read it, but in the book 2, where he's describing the Great Pyramid, and the guide told him that on the pyramid, the hieroglyphs were relating the rations that the workers got paid, how many onions and so on. Of course, it's nothing to do with that at all. It's all to do with, you know, it's the family of the pharaoh and all that. It's dynastic and it's the relation between the pharaoh and the gods. So sometimes we can actually say that he certainly got things wrong, and he certainly knew no other language, and therefore he was always at the mercy of people who were translating when he was dealing with foreign customs and with non-Greek cultures. But having said all that, one has to say that he must have had an amazing ability to process, as well as just to remember, information. And it's not only that he had to remember it as he's traveling around, as he's taking his notes and so on, but this was his life work. You know, some of us write many too many books, and he wrote just one. And like Homer, if you like, you know. the Odyssey, the Iliad, maybe different people did both, but that was enough. Virgil, the Aeneid, you know, there's one great thing. Well, for Herodotus, it was just the histories. That was his life work. So he had to make it count. And one thing that's very extraordinary is when you analyze it, and some people analyze the work almost mechanically, they think they can see a thread going all the way through from the beginning to the end, and they see correspondences and bits of one book that are picked up in another. We call them books, but this is a later division. He just had one seamless work which would be written out on hundreds of bits of papyrus roll. So, you know, to us it is in itself as an artifact, as a product, it is quite phenomenal, whatever one then goes on to say about its flaws or if only he'd done, you know, we all have our things about what we'd like him to have done, which he possibly never considered doing. But what he tried to do, he pretty much carried out fantastically well.
Paul, is the one of the questions that the readers were banding about was to what degree there's evidence that it was a single person that wrote the entirety of the text versus, yeah, you know, were there more than one contributors here? What's that discussion like in the scholarly world, and what's your point of view?
It's not an issue. Maybe what's causing that thought is the Homeric question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there, what's striking about Homer, and it's true of Herodotus, is that a mass of material is organized in accordance with an overarching, or if you like, underlying theme. So lots and lots of myths were told in Greece about the heroic age, but Homer, whoever he was, chose two themes. One, the anger of Achilles, just Achilles, and he doesn't deal with the fall of Troy in the Iliad. And then you've got the Odyssey, which is a personal, it's organized around the experience of one hero, not the most famous, not the most powerful, came from a very tiny island. You know, it's all very unusual that he should have chosen to do what he did, but it had fantastic impact. Well, in the same way, Herodotus took one question. Why did this funny pickup group of small cities, very divided amongst themselves, they'd never faced anything like the kind of invasion that Xerxes mounted, and yet they won. So that was his overarching theme. Why, against all expectations, these very few Greek cities held together long enough and eventually triumphed, with the consequence that that bit of the Greek world was not under the Persian Empire, whereas the bit of the Greek world that he himself came from had been, and subsequently wasn't. So it was quite personally important. But there's no question in Herodotus of stylistic differences from one bit to another. It's utterly consistent throughout. So in other words, as it was a Frenchman originally who said that style is the man himself, say l'homme même, style is the image of the writer, the character. Well, it's consistent throughout. There's no need to ask, did somebody else write any other bit? And as far as I know, there's no ancient source who says, well, obviously a different person wrote this bit of it from the person who wrote that bit of it.
Okay, good, that's helpful. All right, so we know Rebecca shared with us ahead of time a couple of questions that you all would like to ask Paul, but before I get to that, let's hear, are there others that want to jump in live here? I don't know whether Dwight or Elizabeth or Al, Bill or Andrew, Leah, want to jump in and ask Paul a question about a part of the text or something that particularly resonated with you as you were reading the book.
This is Andrew. I have a question.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Andrew. And by the way, where are you calling in from, Andrew?
Houston, Texas.
Excellent.
Welcome.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Gartledge. One thing I noticed while reading Herodotus that was a surprise to me was the resemblance in many parts to Plato's dialogues.
Right.
Especially the Republic. For example, there was one part, I believe, in book 3 or 4 where Cambyses is discussing what is the best form of government with his fellow Persians.
You're absolutely right about that.
And of course, the famous dialogue in book 1 where Croesus is talking to Solon about you know, who's the greatest man, who's the happiest man.
What counts as happiness? Yeah, Plato made it an abstract question. What is happiness? Whereas Herodotus attacked it more concretely in terms of point me to the man and in what respect is he
yes.
the happiest? Why? Yeah, no, you're quite right about that. And
well, my question.
Go on.
My question specifically, I've been reading a little bit of the commentary, tiny bit of the commentary on Herodotus, and I never see this brought up. It could just be because I've read so little, but it seems to me like he had a profound influence on Plato.
Right. Well, now, let me put it this way. Let's stick with what we call the Persian debate in Book 3, where you say the different forms of constitution are discussed, and then Plato picks up on the fact that there are, broadly speaking, 3 types of constitution: rule by one, rule by some, rule by all, and there's a good version of each and a bad version of each. So, for example, rule by one, tyranny, bad, whereas legitimate constitutional monarchy, good. And this, indeed, Herodotus's debate in Book 3 does indeed anticipate Plato, and there may well be a direct relation, and there may actually be a very concrete link between the two. You've possibly come across already a dialogue of Plato, not the Republic, but one just a bit about the same date, but it's called the Protagoras. And this is a debate about what is virtue and can virtue be taught. And Protagoras was a very famous teacher and writer and indeed constitutional draftsman, because he's the sort of Jefferson of a particular Greek city in ancient Greece called Thurii, which is somewhere in now South Italy. And Protagoras was a democrat, and it's been argued that the debate in Herodotus, it's in Herodotus's words, Herodotus wrote it, he refers back to it later, he's quite proud of it, but it got him into a lot of trouble because people couldn't believe that a Persian would ever stand up and say, I think we should have a kind of democracy in Persia. They just found that unbelievable. And actually, I think it is unbelievable. But anyway, it's possible that Herodotus read what Protagoras had written about monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, put it in a historical context, actually an implausible one, but that's what you've read in Herodotus. And so the ultimate source, both of Herodotus and of Plato, is probably the writer-thinker Protagoras. It's a very interesting point that you make there.
Yeah. I've read a bit of commentary on Plato's Republic. Not Protagoras, but I don't see much citation there that Plato could have been influenced by Herodotus.
No, you're quite right. I mean, the reason being that Herodotus is not in the same, as we would say, thought world as Plato for two reasons. One, the kind of thinking that Plato does just wasn't available in the time of Herodotus. Herodotus died roughly when Plato was born. They may have just overlapped, but between the two, there's a huge leap forward in, indeed, what we call the invention of philosophy, and that includes philosophy of language as well as philosophy of morality. And Herodotus simply didn't have the vocabulary available to Plato, who by the way, yeah. was originating a certain amount of the philosophical. The very word philosophia is thought to be an invention of Plato. But Herodotus uses the word sophistes, a wise man. He applies it to Solon. You mentioned Solon debating with Croesus and so on. And there is a continuity, but there's also a very strong discontinuity. So in a way, if you're commenting on Plato, you don't need Herodotus. Whereas if you comment on Herodotus, it is good to think forward to where the Greeks had got within 50 years or so of Herodotus's death.
Thank you.
Wow, rich discussion. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you,
a very
Andrew.
Interesting point indeed, Andrew. Yeah,
yeah,
thanks.
I wonder if anyone has a what I might call a naive question.
yeah.
For, you know, something maybe you haven't read commentaries, which would be fine. reading Herodotus itself is a great feat. So we just touched on the Solon Croesus discussion, and I think
yeah.
Rebecca. You know, that's obviously one of the great discussions of Herodotus. Did what did you guys think about that? And is there anything about that that you'd like to ask, Paul? Was
Bill you or if it was you Dwight who had when we started reading in the very beginning. Made the comment that you thought that that was like the moral of the entirety of the history. And so I'd be interested to know if you guys still think that.
And what was the moral? Was it that you can't judge any individual's life, whether it's good or bad, until you see it all the way through to the end? And famously, Solon is made to say, call no man fortunate or happy until you see how he dies, in what way he dies, with what end his life terminates. Or was it about more the issue of fortune, of luck? And that's partly a thing to do with the gods. It's partly sheer chance. And that is, fortune, Herodotus starts his whole work by saying that what were once big cities are today
yeah.
small. And so the implication is, the inference he draws, cities
right.
that today are big and powerful and happy, successful, will one day, sort of inevitably, by this wheel of fortune idea, be small and unhappy and so on. So don't count on being where you are now if you're prosperous. Conversely, if you're not in a good place, well, the wheel of fortune may well turn and you may be better off in the future. But thing is, not to take what is now as a given and as more or less eternal. And that, I think, is a powerful message. I mean, it is not a comforting one if you happen to be doing rather well. It suggests that you will not do well in the future and you might end badly. But, yeah, and that, I think, is actually Greeks were quite pessimistic in general. And most of them did not have a very strong belief in an afterlife. So this world, this life, that's what matters, and so it's very good if you're prosperous and materially, you've got a good family, you've got descendants. This is the story of when Croesus asks Solon,
who is
happiest? Yeah, and he comes up with somebody that obviously Croesus, a Lydian, would never have heard of, an Athenian who died in a battle quite a long time ago, not in a major battle, and the guy had never really made a name. He wasn't a king. he wasn't, you know, and so on. So he's really upset to be told that this, to him, insignificant person is much happier than he, Croesus, is.
Yeah. Yeah, so what did, you know, I've struggled with this, and actually this passage, probably this part of Herodotus, in addition to the intro, Paul, that you referred to, where
yeah.
you know, cities that were bigger once are now small, and cities that are small may become big. And I appreciated you linking those two. That's really resonated, and I've thought a lot about this over the years. But, and by the way, I think I told you this, Paul, that 2005, I was giving keynote speeches in the business world about my work with customers and the internet, but I also spoke about the coming crisis in real estate in the real estate market in the U.S. I had no idea that was going to be as bad as it was, but I knew something was coming, and I actually quoted Herodotus and that introductory passage to my business audience.
Well, there you go. Well, now Croesus is a particularly interesting character because in the encounter with Solon, the Greek, the Athenian, he comes off much the worst. But then the narrative resumes, and Croesus is the starting point of his whole story because Croesus conquered Greeks, first of all. Then he got too big for his boots. And he thought he was going to conquer the Persian Empire. What an idiot. So he gets, well, he gets defeated and he gets put on a pyre to be burnt at the stake. And then Herodotus chooses to believe the version that he's miraculously saved from being burnt at the stake. At any rate, he then in Herodotus becomes an advisor to Cyrus, the great Persian emperor. And so from being done down by Solon, a Greek, he suddenly becomes the wise advisor to Cyrus of Persia. And the Greek audience, Herodotus is, of course, speaking in Greek. He's reciting his history, or he's writing it for Greeks, not for non-Greeks. Then suddenly they're asked to think that this guy that has been put down, first of all, Croesus, bad guy, becomes a good guy who gives useful lessons to Persia, and they're useful because, well, most Greeks will have thought it was a bit of a miracle that we defeated the Persians, that the Persians didn't defeat us, but they might come back any time. And so the comfort would be, as Croesus says to Cyrus, beware, you know, don't imagine that you're always going to be as prosperous and successful as you are now. You've just defeated me. Don't let that go to your head. And look what might happen in the future. So that foretells the defeat of Xerxes, which is what happens. But still, then the wheel of fortune can still roll the other way. So Greeks, they're put on the alert by Herodotus. From the word go, right through the first, we call it a book, but the first main storyline, which takes you through to the conquest of Asia by Cyrus, it is, the message is, just beware. Don't think above your station. Remember you're human. Even the greatest, most powerful human individuals, they're subject to some random force which is above them called fate or chance. And it's partly divine, it's partly just random, and don't overdo it, basically.
So let's go back to your first question, Paul, which is about how did Bill or Dwight or anyone, what did you see as the moral of the morality here expressed? Did you see it in one of the two ways Paul outlined, or did you see it a different way? What did you take?
Is there a single message in this, though? Is it a moral message, or is it a religious, theological message, or is it indeed a political message?
Yeah.
Excuse me, this is Elizabeth. I'm going to get off because I just keep coughing, and I don't want to, you know, disturb the conversation.
Put us on mute so you can at least hear a little bit more. of the conversation.
I don't
know
if I have a mute. I'll look and see if I have a mute button.
You do, actually. It's star six. The conference system, it, you know, not your phone itself. But if you hit...
On my cell phone, I have a mute. So I'll call back on my cell phone.
Okay.
Okay,
sure.
Thanks.
Sure. Okay. All right, so someone was jumping in there, I think.
Hi, this is Dwight.
Hey, Dwight.
Rebecca, her earlier question was sort of referring to the question I had raised about, I don't know that I used the word moral, but that would be pretty close to probably what I had said. And at the time, I'd asked something about, you know, at the very end, to keep in mind for the whole thing would be the soft lands make soft people. And I definitely have changed the way I do that, getting to Paul's description that, you know, the purpose of this work is to explain how this itty bitty group of people defeated the Persians. And that's one of the many things, you know, those are soft lands making soft people. That's one of many reasons that he raised us during the talk. And so, yeah, I definitely view that that differently now than I did at the start.
Hmm. Dwight, have you read all the way through to the end of Herodotus, the very last chapter, as it were, the very last paragraph of the work?
Yes.
Yeah, because it ends with a Persian speaking, you know, not a Greek. And he's addressing his own people, and it's way back in the past. It's not in the present or near present. It's not the time of the actual fighting that he describes. And so it must have some point, you know, some, there must be a message there. And what Cyrus is saying is really... hard lands produce tough people, and if you seek to conquer lands which are more lush, which are easier to work, or if you seek just to take other people's goods, what they've produced, well, you're going to sit back, you're going to get a bit lazy, you're going to get a bit out of condition, and then, well, things might go bad for you. So, I mean, there is a message there that austerity, dare I use the word today, is a little bit of a, yeah, we've had too much austerity. But as Aristotle would say, too much of anything is wrong, because you should always get just the right amount of whatever it is. But there is a kind of austerity there, a self-denying message that somehow you're morally better if you have to overcome obstacles, and you're morally better if you restrain your desires. And that has a broader political implication for an empire. And of course, Cyrus is founder of an empire. Don't think too big. Don't constantly wish to expand. And if you expand, you'll reach a limit, and then you'll exceed the limit, and any excess is liable to produce the contrary reaction, which will be to halt you, and not just halt you, but deprive you of what you already have. So I think that's how I read the last very, very end of the work. But there's an awful lot in between the beginning and the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Katerina here. I just wanted to build on what was just said, based on the opening line, where he actually sets up the ending in a way where he says, so that human events do not fade with time. And then at the end, it's sort of kind of like the end of a parable, where in the beginning of this call, I mentioned that I felt one of the overriding messages was that it was almost an invitation to cultivate self-awareness, because I saw Herodotus more as a truth seeker than as a historian, because I really don't know what the litmus test for a historian really is, now or then.
Well, let me put it to you this, that he, as we said at the beginning, this is a huge work. It's actually the longest single bit of one work, Greek prose, that survived. Would you, if you really were a seeker after the truth in a philosophical sense, bother to go to all the effort to traverse the distances he did, to meet the range of people he did, to experience the hardships he no doubt did in accumulating his material. And then finally, would you want to narrate quite so many events, facts, if what really you're after is the essence of things? I mean, it seems to me there are two types of mentalities, and they seem to me to be in conflict.
Well, I think one might do that if they were seeking some kind of immortality in the book. I mean, it's
right.
Still with us. So I can't speak for what the motivation was for including all that. And I often wonder, I lost track of things so many times, but
yes.
I did find
He does periodically say, doesn't he, that digression is part of my project, which I think may be just a kind of let out. But he is one of these, you know, he is one of these thinkers who is very discursive. He goes off at a tangent. Something interests him.
Well, so I love the digression because that gave me pause to think and bring myself into it and make it relevant for me personally, or, you know, whether I came to any true conclusion. I mean, we can't really say what is the search for the truth. I mean, we'll only know the relative truth. There's many sides to any story. You can go to a family and have two siblings tell about their, you know, speak about their upbringing, and you'll get two totally different stories. So I don't know that we can really, I don't know. I just felt that there was this idea that maybe he was building on the metaphor of being the master of one's own ship. And I saw some of the countries that helped me to think about the empires and the nations and states almost as characters when I was getting lost, because my mind needed to grasp something when I couldn't, you know, hold on to all the details.
No, well, you're right about the personal, the subjective nature of the work. He uses the pronoun I in various cases 375 times, and it's been counted. And he is very much giving you the impression, this is my version, as opposed to this is the truth, the absolute truth, the objective truth. And therefore, you're right. Your reaction is exactly what he wants. He wants you to intervene, to take a personal stance on what he says. And I think he leads you. He wants you to think. Sometimes he comes out straight, doesn't he, and says, you know, this is how things are. For example, famous passage where you've got the contradiction between the customs of the Greeks, the customs of the Indians, and it's set in a Persian context. Well, he says, custom is king of all, as Pindar put it, by which I mean that every people chooses and believes best possible, best of all, the customs that it, the people, have been brought up in. They're the traditional customs that make them who they are. So, I mean, you can agree or disagree with that, but it's a very strongly stated point of view. It's not just optional. He really does believe that, and he gives examples. He illustrates that. So he is a moralist in that sense. But overall, the ultimate thrust is chronological and explanatory. And so that seems to me, those two things seem to me particular to historians. You can be a philosopher without being interested in chronology and without being interested in narrative very much. You may tell yourself stories, but that's not what makes you a philosopher, or that's certainly more the province of a historian than of a moralist or a philosopher.
Yeah. I'll tell you, one of the things that I love about Herodotus, and there are many things I love about Herodotus in this book, and I'll tell each of you, I know you're going to groan when I say this, but now that you've read it once, you have the great opportunity to read it again. The second time, it's even better. And I know that's even harder possibly to contemplate, but you see more of the structure and the architecture of the book, which is just amazing. But one of the things that I think the book asks an important but often related to as dangerous question, which is, how is it that these Greeks and Persians came to fight? You know, and that question, which seemingly sounds innocuous, often is seen as quite dangerous. you know, after 2001 here in New York, if you actually tried to ask the question, how is it that Saudi Arabians, primarily Saudi Arabians, decided to fly planes, hijack planes and fly into our buildings, you would be treated as treasonous almost, because it was seen as the pursuit to try to understand how it is that that happened was seen as somehow agreeing with the actions that were taken.
This is a
dangerous question, and I think it is one of the fundamental questions, of course, of history, of a good historian. How is it that these events, you know, came to take place? And
Herodotus, and
he asked that question. What I don't understand fundamentally is how is it that the guy who invented the genre of history, and I'm sure we know there were others before him that did local histories, but tended to be more about the kings and the families, and in a way to please those persons, not a serious enterprise like this one. But how did the first one who did a serious attempt at history create what is still today one of the best histories available to us?
Well, there's something called genius, and some people think that genius is 99% perspiration and only 1% inspiration. But I think the balance is probably a bit more the other way.
Yeah.
The view that it takes, you've got to put in an awful lot of work. Like Einstein doesn't come up with the theory of relativity in year one. He works away on all sorts of mathematical questions, physics questions, and after about 10 years, he comes up with it. So I think Herodotus spent, you know, I bet there's a lot of trial and error before he gets to what we have, anywhere near what we have. So that's part of the explanation. As I say, he was lucky, he was spared, he had the energy, he had the resources, mental, physical, material, to enable him to achieve this extraordinary project.
Yeah.
So, it's a very good, and I agree with you that it's dangerous to study international relations between cultures which are sometimes very different, very distinct, and potentially destructive, mutually destructive. And he comes out, I mean, what I like about him is that he gives credit where he thinks credit's due, regardless of ethnicity or... So he's not ethnocentric, and he can be very rude about his fellow Greeks, just as he can be very praising of non-Greeks. So that's quite unusual.
Right. Cool. Well, what else? Leah, did you want to ask a question of Paul directly, or?
If I can help not being starstruck. I got to fess up here, Paul. I read your book on Thermopylae well before I even thought about reading Herodotus. My parents bought it for me for Christmas a couple of years ago, and it's been really fun to reread it. And I know that you also study the Spartans, and one interesting aspect about Spartan culture that I've come across in multiple works, including yours, is the fact that they had to, it's like the baby tax. They had to pay in order to reproduce. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how strange it seems to the modern reader, the reader in the 21st century, and sort of the effect of the baby tax, if you will, on Spartan culture.
Say a little bit more about what you mean by that expression.
In Sparta, it cost money in order to have a child. Hold on, I'm going to the index of your book so I can.
I mean, I'm wondering if you're thinking about if you have three children, then you get excused from certain public obligations. If you have four, you get excused. Is that the issue? A kind of a central release from certain obligations which you would otherwise have to pay, but if you produce children for the good of the the community, then you're excused.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, that's one very interesting thing, but they're, of course, very fanatic about reproduction in general, and they took all sorts of measures to, as they saw it, both increase maximally the numbers of children born and surviving, and the quality of the children born and surviving, so that they should be as strong and capable as possible, particularly for the males. But the unusual thing to me about Sparta is that the society was geared almost as much to the good of, to the advance of, the female half of the population, who were empowered in various ways, which was not the case in other Greek cities. So Spartan
certainly
women
not.
Could, they could own land, they could have some say in who they married. They ran the homes because, of course, the men were typically away from them. They had some sort of education. There's all sorts of ways in which they're much more equal to the male half of the population than was the case in, for example, Athens, where there was a huge gulf. But what we in the West, in the modern world, sometimes find deeply shocking, but it wasn't peculiar to Sparta, was the kind of brutally frank attitude they took to, if a child was disabled when born, the Spartans took to the extreme the view that they weren't worth rearing. And they could explain it away on all sorts of grounds. Maybe it was God's will that the child had been born with some disability, whatever, whatever. But fact was, they were quite brutal in, we use the euphemism, exposing. But what that means is a kind of infanticide. And it was sanctioned by the law, by the way in which the Spartans organized their society. So that's a feature of it which to us is callous and unfeeling, and we would even say inhuman today.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's actually a lot of what I was looking for. I actually just found the Greek word for it. It's called technopoieia.
Yes, right. That's the Greek for reproduction, literally the making of children. And they, as I say, they took great care that the marriage rituals were particularly stark, and if people did not marry when they were supposed to get married, there were all sorts of public rituals of humiliation and exclusion. So both positively and negatively, both the carrot and the stick were applied to maximize the reproductive capacity. But interestingly, it didn't entirely work, and there are all sorts of reasons given for why the Spartan citizen population seems to decline after the period Herodotus is talking about. There were about 8,000 adult male Spartans, 20 plus, but by about a century later, there were only about 1,000. So something's happened. Either they're not reproducing, or they're somehow reproducing, but they're not fulfilling the same civic roles, be counted as soldiers, whatever it is. Something goes wrong in Spartan social arrangements actually during the lifetime of Herodotus, and it's partly probably causes beyond their control. There was a massive earthquake which would have killed thousands, and
yeah,
it's very difficult to reproduce, to sort of get the numbers back up in an ancient traditional society. So that would have been one of the factors.
Yeah.
They are very fascinating from that point of view. You're quite right.
Paul, could you say a little bit about what, you know, so you're a leading authority on Sparta. That's clearly an area you chose to you chose to really focus on Sparta. What you know, Athens is of course classically the favorite in Western civilization, and Sparta is always seen as not very interesting. And you certainly proved that wrong. But what attracted you to studying Sparta originally, and what?
Yeah. Well, just to take your first point, actually Sparta was found equally interesting by many thinkers, both in antiquity and in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. So the fact
that
most of the sources that people who survive the written evidence comes from Athenians or people who worked in or lived in Athens, that doesn't take away, if you like, the fascination, because Sparta was sort of seen as the alternative pole. So if you didn't like what was going on in Athens, for whatever reason, then you might look for Sparta as a kind of alternative. Anyway, my own personal interest was partly purely accidental, that I wanted to do research in archaeology in pre-classical, that is 8th, 7th, 6th century BC Greece. And I went to talk to the man that I wanted to be my supervisor, John Boardman, who said to me, well, you know, the British School of Archaeology at the beginning of the 20th century excavated several sites in Sparta over a period of about 10, 15 years. That material is in the museum in Sparta, and because of a convention, if a foreign school excavates certain material, then members of that school have a kind of prior right to go and study it again. And the Greeks are going to let you do it. So he said, well, there's been a lot of work on Spartan archaeology and indeed on the archaeology of that period in Greece in general. What you should do, Paul, is give an up-to-date summary of the state of our evidence and understanding of what Spartan was like in terms of, we now call it, material culture. Now, that immediately ran up against a part of the ancient evidence, which sometimes we speak of the Spartan myth, sometimes we speak of the Spartan mirage. In other words, it's a kind of picture of Sparta which doesn't correspond to the reality, but which people want to believe. And one of these aspects was that Sparta was not just a place which didn't produce much good art. I mean, physical, material, sculpture, painting, temples and so on, but actually positively was against producing it, that there was somehow some national characteristic or national view that such activity was harmful, was a waste of time, was a distraction from the real business of life, which was war and physical preparation. But yeah, well, the British School's excavations, one of its functions, one of the great results of it was to show that that was a myth in our sense. In other words, untrue. It was lacking in basis in reality. And actually, Sparta had been, for a while, and in some respects, not just quite good at producing bronze work, sculpture, pottery, but actually leading, you know, one of the leading areas where craftsmen produced the best or the most desired or the most attractive examples of these different types of artifacts. So I was to do that, but because I was a historian, this is the Herodotus in me coming out, I wanted to know why Sparta developed the way it was. And to me, the most peculiar fact about Sparta was when it expanded, when it started conquering, like the Persian Empire, outside its own immediate territory in the plain of Sparta, when it started conquering territory over a mountain range and then wanted to hang on to that territory and to hang on to the people living there that it conquered, it turned these Greek people into a kind of slaves. Yeah. And though there were other places in Greece which had populations which were native but were enslaved, the Spartans did it on a much bigger scale, and it was done in such a way that it transformed their whole society so that everything was ultimately based on making these poor Greeks called helots do the work, the agriculture, the craftsmanship, everything which the Spartans then did not have to do, and they could spend their time in other ways, which they did, in preparing ultimately for being the best fighters in the Greek world. But one of the reasons they had to be the best fighters was to keep down these local people. So in my youth, I was very left-wing, and I was very upset by the way the Spartans treated these fellow Greeks, and I still am, actually. But yeah, that was what prompted me to try to relate the material culture of this region to this brutal political fact about exploitation.
Yeah.
Oh, so there am I.
Yeah. Well, that's, thank you.
Welcome.
Well, how are we doing? I was wondering, Rebecca, if you wanted to say a few words about what this experience has been like for you to lead a discussion with adults as opposed to, you know, college
yeah,
students.
Yeah, because, you know, my 18 to 22-year-olds are not as talkative as this group has been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than Leia.
Well, yeah, other than Leia. Exemplar, you know, an exemplar of what we would all love to have in our classroom. It's been really great. I do have, you know, it's been a challenge for me because my life is a little bit hectic. And I think it was nice to actually have a group of people that I'm interacting with and discussing these things with who want to do it just for the sheer pleasure of it, and whose lives are just as crazy as mine is.
But now, you see, you're slightly different in that they have gone through college and not, for whatever reason, done anything ancient, probably, when they were at college. But you are not yet at college. You have the chance to do something Greek, Roman, you know, to study the ancients while you're at college.
Yes, I mean, Leah still has an opportunity to understand this life. But, you know, when people like Fred or Dwight or Bill, you know, or Katarina, just they couldn't make it on the call because, you know, they had a meeting that conflicted or something. I felt bad for them because they really wanted to be able to do this. But, you know, we have children. We have work. We have
And actually, Fred was... Fred was not only in his business, but he was running for political office while he was.
Yes, he was.
And he won.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
This is a friend of mine from high school, Paul, Fred Whitaker, out in California. We were good friends in high school and reconnected again recently, and he read Herodotus with us. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I was very jealous of him because he went to London to see his daughter, who was attending a study abroad there and who was performing in the Euripides' Bacchae while she was there.
Wow. Yeah, but I know that one. That was, I think, King's London, wasn't it?
Yep.
Terrific.
That was it.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing.
Yeah, so it's been an interesting experience reading this kind of a discussion. And, of course, no one can see anyone's face either. Which makes it a little bit different. But what I really enjoyed about it was the ability to just let them lead us where we wanted to go. Instead of me trying to pull teeth.
That's
great.
Phil,
well, I better say perhaps I should be hitting the hay, hitting the sack.
Yes.
It's now midnight 20 for me. Sorry about the time difference, which I got wrong.
No worries. Completely. No, that's our. Obviously, we should have done a better job. And thank you again, Paul, for calling in. And just before everyone leaves, I want to say that we're going to do a webinar with Paul and Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor of The New Yorker, in May. On this being the 2,500-year anniversary of the introduction of comedy into the theater in Athens. And we really would love you to have you join us for that conversation in May. We'll send you a link to register. We also will, I think, and Rebecca, you and I should talk about this, but I'd like to run next a discussion group on Thucydides. Because if you've read Herodotus, you've got to read Thucydides. And, you know, they're two great historians who stand at opposite poles in some ways in terms of the art of history.
Yeah.
And of course, Thucydides, you know, writes about the wars between Athens and Sparta and, you know, sort of a follow-up, if you will, to Herodotus and the Persian Wars.
What Herodotus was warning against, really.
That's right. Some people think that Herodotus was finishing this, right, and writing those final pages at the beginning of the war.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
And that he was writing to his fellow Greeks who were now engaged in an inter-Greek war.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
We're going to do Homer in the fall. So if you haven't done Homer with us, we'd love to have you be a part of that. And I think, Paul, you and I need to talk, but the next Roman work we may do is Tacitus, I think.
Would be great.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
There's a new book coming out shortly by Tom Holland, and it's on the Julians and the Claudians, the first emperors, from Julius Caesar to Nero. And, of course, Tacitus, for much of that, is our main source.
Right,
right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we would love for you to continue to participate with us. Certainly, the webinar in May will be well worth tuning in.
Yeah, that's May the 11th.
That's right, Monday, May the 11th. That'll be at 7 o'clock New York time. And Rebecca, thank you so much for jumping in, and to all of you, congratulations, really.
Thank you.
You deserve a great certificate from us for reading this text.
We must. You're right. We'll get something together. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I so appreciate this.
Thank you, Dr. Hartley.
Bye for now. Bye.
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 All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye,
Rebecca.
Everyone.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. No problem, Phil.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone.
Buddy.
Thanks, Phil. Bye, Rebecca. Bye, everyone.
Okay.
Bye.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, Phil.